I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive's fucked. Zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my.
Hello and welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and we are building a bigger, dumber Concorde boondoggle.
Yeah. Are we, though? I mean, it's hard. I mean, that's a tough act to follow.
I think it's kind of a cursed name in projects now at this point, after you have the failed aircraft, which was, you know...
I don't think the Concorde succeeded at what it was doing. It just, you know, it was a supersonic people mover, right? I mean, it did. Unlike the video game, it did the job. Like, it was functional.
From what I hear, the game is functional. It's just,
That's true. I guess I haven't played it, but then no one else did either. For those who I don't know, probably people are at least dimly aware, but.
It is funny to think things get gayer and dumber as, like, the new our generation's Concorde is this art is not as cool a boondoggle, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's this was it 8 year long project? 8 years, which and it's funny because even before, so I guess we should back up. So Sony Corporation put together a, now I'm actually even, it's a, what is it, a team shooter? Is that right?
A hero shooter? It's an Overwatch.
Hero shooter. It's an Overwatch clone, yeah? More or less?
Yeah, let's call it that. Yeah, I think so.
I was seeing some commentary when the project started, Fortnite had just gone from 1 million to more than 30 million players in a span of like a month, surpassing the PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which was before Fortnite, the number at that point, the number one game. You know, Battle Royale was a it was originally called Fortnite Battle Royale, right? That was the new hotness. And
Also, it's like this problem where it's like that hotness was chasing the old hotness of like arena hero shooter was like already a dying breed when that started, right? Like by that the Battle Royale shooter was the new thing, and then they wanted to do the old thing, right?
I don't think it really matters. I would have to look and double check when, because like I think hero shooters grew out of Battle Royale. It doesn't really matter.
No, because, I mean, TF2. I think TF2 predates.
Well, but that's not a hero shooter, is it?
It's absolutely a hero shooter. class shooter, whatever. You want to call
class
it,
shooter, yes, that for sure. But I don't know about quote unquote hero shooter per se, and it doesn't really matter. Yeah, so 8 years later. Now, I had actually not, like, my first exposure to Concorde, the video game, was a 45% out of 100 review on PC Gamer that was just like, oh, there's this kind of generic, whatever, yeah, team shooter, multiplayer, hero shooter thing that kind of sucks. There's nothing, doesn't add anything to the genre and has various problems. Nothing.
It's also like full price. It's $40.
$40, right? Instead of free to play.
Also, like Call of Duty is free to play at this point. Like,
well, certainly not the camp. Yes, but the
basically, yeah,
yeah, Warzone or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. And then it released.
So I had never heard of it. But my point is, though, I had literally never, because I guess if you were in PlayStation space, then you would have heard of it, because I guess there was some big marketing campaign or something, which. Also, as a, like a side note, but also kind of like a intertwined story with this, I actually didn't understand. It took me a while to separate in my mind to realize that Concorde and Dustborn are two different games, two different things. I understand they're different genres. I mean, so Dustborn is the other total failure of a, I don't know what do we call woke. I don't even know how. I don't know. I guess Dustborn is literally like an Antifa training game or something.
I have seen screenshots of it and like gameplay clips, and I legitimately think it might be satire. Like, I'm not even like, that's like, like there's a bit like a call in you can use to accuse other person of racism.
Yes, yeah, I saw that. And yes, and, like, and triggered is like a status or something. It's like a quasi RPG, I guess.
It's like the, if you play like the Telltale Walking Dead game, it's okay. Like a Telltale game, I think.
Oh, it's a Telltale game. See, I actually have Telltale. I literally like Telltale. The artwork was insufficiently distinguished, and I didn't really. I guess I don't know. I couldn't. To me, the story was like, oh, there's this game that's like super woke that totally flopped. Which, okay, we can like criticize, you know, the anti woke product enjoyment. Or whatever, you know, the A-log community, and that has problems. Okay, fine, but still, I'm just literally explaining. It rose to the level of, oh, there's this thing happening. I didn't understand there were actually two things happening that were in certain ways quite similar, even though the games themselves are in other ways quite different. And yeah, it's there's like apparently with Dustborn, which is the it's I guess you gain abilities that are like. Like trigger, I think
accuse of racism.
Accuse of racism, yes, and to call out, yeah, and then you like shame racists into joining Antifa or something. I don't. Again, I have only the vaguest awareness of but I guess the thing to me is the I guess concept art or the cover art or whatever you want to call it is indistinguishable. Which yes, and this is a common, you know, critique. Oh my God, that's like going back to Trump 2016 era. What is it? Humans of Flat Earth. And this kind of thing, but yeah,
flat
there's
design. Flat design.
Humans flat design. Flat. Thank you. Yes, humans of flat design. Yes,
we're all humans of flat Earth.
Yeah. yeah, yeah. So the flat design thing.
The game flopped. I do think it's being refunded. It's flopped in 2 weeks and being refunded. I do believe it will come out free to play. Like, there's no way.
I don't know. I mean, so just slow down and back up just a little bit. Yeah, the so when we were kicking around, like, oh, we should do a new nigger, the news had not yet come through. But yes, as of like yesterday, as of this recording, Sony, because the reaction was immediate and damning, and it was I don't think they broke 1,000 concurrent players at launch, and the concurrent players like a week after launch was 30 or something.
Yeah, people couldn't find games, basically. Like, they couldn't matchmake.
It was literally a dead game after a week. Literally, you could not. You could search and never. You would never find a match. So, So Sony took the more or less unprecedented step, I believe, of not just so quickly offering refunds, but offering it across, like, irrespective of. I mean, they're essentially automated refunds happening for Steam and Epic sales to the extent they, however many copies they actually sold. They are proactively, preemptively refunding the people who purchased it. I saw one guy trying to sell his physical copy on eBay for $25,000. It's super rare. It's $25,000.
That's a good bit, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I
want to talk about the financial aspect of this game because I have some autism on it.
Yeah.
So, this is kind of, whole thing is kind of a venture capital scam. Have you ever heard of a company called Probably Monsters?
No, I know Sweet Baby, which is part of the, but no, I don't know.
No, so Probably Monsters is founded by a bunch of ex-Bungie execs, and their shtick is basically like venture capital for game development studios, where you invest early, like they get them off the ground, basically like AAA studios from nothing, because this is Fireworks' first game. They have never released a game. This is purely like this is their only project ever. They have no lineage that they're spitting on, right? So Probably Monsters spins up these studios, and then the thing is they will get like either acquired by somebody else, like in this case it was Sony. And then I think that, and that's, I think, cause they, I think Probably Monsters, they're probably smart businessmen to some degree. They actually used to have an in-house studio and they just stopped making games in 2023. Now they just do this venture capital bit, where they, I think that they spin up these studios and try to get them bought by one of the big, you know, I guess the big two, Sony and Microsoft. And I think that works because the shortage of, like there's not many exclusives anymore, and there's not many games really that are console only. So like, there's incentive to have the to acquire these games just to have anything in the pipeline. So they, it's like venture capital, right? They get a bunch of money from investors. They exist and they have a viable product they can pitch, and then they get acquired by Sony, Microsoft, or some other large publisher. So in many ways, this is kind of a scam, right? To some degree, because like, no one knows who the, you know, what these games are going to actually turn out as. But it kind of takes some risk away from the big two, because they, or even the, or the, you know, big publisher like EA could in theory acquire one of these two, because new IP is hard. But the great thing with new IP, much like a new startup, is that, oh, like the theoretical future gains are infinite, right? So like, you could make with relatively, well, not small, it's in the millions of dollars, but relatively small investments can have big panouts when they get bought by a big stupid corporation. That would be like generally, because like these studios are, or the publishers are risk averse in new IP, but they do understand they need new IP. So there's kind of something going on there. I don't think probably Monsters has ever actually had a hit. So there's that, and it is kind of.
What else do you know? What else they have financed? Because I have no idea.
They had a dev studio called Cauldron and a dev studio called Battle Barge. Battle Barge is currently their only thing they like own, but I can't find much on them. It also seems like it's kind of a ex Bungie house. Like they hire a lot of ex Bungie devs for their projects. So, yeah, mostly. So it's kind of, ideally, if you were to look at this in a Steel Man, it's like a Bungie's taking care of their, like, you know, their people who have like left Bungie as it got worse, trying to spin off their own things. Or you can say this is totally a fucking scam. Either way.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
but Sony fully acquired Firewalk before that. Like, it pretty much just sold it. They cashed out basically on Firewalk, and probably made a boatload of money actually on that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So there was an exit on the part of the, that's funny. And Sony was stuck with the.
They are a private firm. They're not like a. They're a private firm. They're not. So there's not much like information on their.
Sure, on their balance sheet or whatever. Yeah. Speaking of finances,
estimated budget was between $100 and $200 million. Probably not. Well, so they had a lot of staff. They had about. They said high single digits. So like more than 75 people. You know, for many years. Yeah.
Well, and then the other thing is with games that size, like movies, marketing trends toward about half of the overall cost. Which was what I was saying before.
Was there marketing for this though?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you see it, it's for you, right? So I didn't see it because it's not for me. But people were saying online, at least as I understand it, in particular PlayStation, like people who just. Apparently it was being pushed very, very hard on Sony storefronts and stuff like that. I don't know, like, other than Sony stuff, if or where they spent much marketing budget. And I guess for Sony, a lot of that would be, technically speaking, probably, you know, it's internal money shuffling. Like, the money comes... Sony doesn't actually necessarily have to pay it because the money comes out from one part of Sony and goes into a different part of Sony, right? So okay, fine, but still, as far as like the nominal investment in the project, it's also on the finance note, and in terms of the comparison with Dustborn, I think that Dustborn's, as I understand it, their budget was a lot smaller. However, it was significantly financed, like
by the Swedish government, right?
Norwegian, yeah,
by Norwegian government, yeah, Lemo.
So yeah,
legitimately, that money would have been better served going to Zelensky, like personally.
Oh yeah,
hand him a check. Like.
Oh my goodness! I mean, it's just I mean, maybe that's a good. I don't know how much more video game news you necessarily want to, or what you've been playing, or what you would want to talk about. But
I will. I do want to show Synthetic Man, who is our guy, but he's playing under the radar. But like, he will just slip up occasionally on his live streams on YouTube. Is like probably the best YouTube reviewer, our guy around right now. I do recommend his review of Black Myth Wukong.
Okay, cool.
he does point out some things about it, that, you know, it's not a perfect game, obviously, right? It's got problems. But I, like, if you're issued, if
mechanically
you're
or politically or both,
mechanically, like, oh, okay. So I were kind of looking at his review. It's got a lot of like invisible wall stuff.
Oh no.
It's like, it's also very linear. Like, it's not like, a Souls-like in that respect.
Well, I was about to say, in terms of, because I know that the people talk about it as a Souls-like, and one thing about the original Dark Souls, obviously Elden Ring was almost completely non-linear. The original Dark Souls was more linear, had this lovely intertwined map that was like, I never felt invisible walls in Dark Souls. It was just like, I mean, the environments occasionally were quite expansive, sometimes claustrophobic, but at no point did I feel...
Yeah.
That kind of a thing, yeah.
I will say, it does look... So it is a... From his review and his footage, he has a lot of really great footage. I would probably recommend it. It's a long-form video review if you're into that kind of 45-minute review of video game thing. But it seems like it is... Like, the boss fights are hard. It is almost kind of a boss rush, he said. Like, it's tons of really cool boss fights, lots and lots of boss fights, with the enemies in between being kind of, you know, forgettable.
I mean, that was my experience of Elden Ring, frankly.
Really, I enjoyed the ambushes and the fuckery.
Sometimes, but it was, I mean...
But anyway, it's easier. So, like, also, kind of fitting, it's not one of those games. It's got, like, similar, like, you can't get hit by the bosses too many times, but you are significantly more powerful, like, than an Elden Ring character relative to the bosses. Mm-hmm. I'm not even joking. I've been reading Journey to the West now.
Nice.
It's long.
Yeah.
Journey to the West is about... a very powerful character, right? Very powerful character. So, like, you are basically, you know, doing you are playing the handsome monkey king as his, or which is my favorite title of his. And you own like, it's
in epic literature, it's called an epithet.
Yeah. It's a boss fight story. And yeah. I do think, like, cool. Legitimately, I don't want to be like, read the book. From what I can, he says the story is very light if you haven't read, and he hadn't read it, so he kind of didn't know, have any idea what's going on. And it's not like Dark Souls with hidden lore, it's just like, assumes you have read Journey to the West. Which is a big ask, honestly.
Right. Well, especially the Western audience, right?
Yeah, yeah. Someone who's trying to read Journey to the West, very big ask.
Mm. Interesting.
Enjoying Journey to the West, though. I am appreciating how, like, all the constant nods to... I'm surprised I don't know the origins of it super well. I know that it was kind of codified in early 1600s, but it seems like in the way, if you've ever read the Aeneid, it's kind of a national epic of the early Roman imperial period that's like unifying its culture.
Well, explicit. I mean, that's, I mean, Virgil,
putting, yeah, no, it's like, a political
literally work. Commissioned to do that.
Yes. This has a very similar thing where it's like unifying all the it's very, it's like, I knew this about it, but like reading it, it's like very intentional. Like, this one-off character that Sun Wukong meets is a Confucius ideal person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and like this person is a kind of a, you know, a wizard type Chinese person. This is, of course, there are, you know, Buddhas and such. And
the story itself, I actually have never read it myself. It is to go and get Buddhist scriptures from the West, right?
I am in the Chinese Taoist magic phase of the book.
Okay.
Buddhas have been referenced, but not, I'm not yet in the part of the narrative where, like, we're dealing with a lot of Buddhas. Bodhisattvas are constantly around, but they're always referenced, not really talked about. But I imagine it's going to come around more.
Cool. Well,
there is a scene in the review. It's like just in the background while he's talking in the synthetic man review where he's like talking to a Buddha, like a Bodhisattva type figure. So I'm excited. I really do want to actually read the book before I play the game.
Yeah. Sounds like a good,
it's going to take me like
plan. Yeah. Yeah. But then you'll be so much better educated. I mean, that's, you know, that's a cultural education that, yeah. It's quite valuable. So, yeah, I should do that myself, frankly. So I guess that... And have you... What about playing real quick? What have you been playing? if anything?
Yes, I've been playing my usual like BattleTech or MechWarrior, but that's just, I'm not gonna count that.
Oh yeah, and I saw Clans is coming soon. That's exciting.
Soon, yeah, soon TM.
Yeah, right.
But I did do some bouncing off of forgettable games.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to play the 4K Mechanicus, which is a very interesting XCOM like.
That caught my interest.
Gimmick is interesting, where your attacks don't miss, ever.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So
yes.
You do a variable amount of damage, based on your.
Like, I always thought that would be like, it struck me playing through XCOM 2 for the whatever time. I was like, you know, these are highly trained soldiers. The set, like, even the quote unquote rookies, like. Chance to miss is kind of gay compared to, like, you know, even just doing if you have 100 hit points, you do one hit point of damage, but that's guaranteed, right? Sometimes you're in a situation where even in XCOM, that's the thing about XCOM is especially XCOM 2, but really both and of the rebooted ones, guaranteed damage tends to be much more valuable than variable damage that could be zero or could be higher than the guarantee. Like you're just gonna like it. At least the way I played became management of abilities to do guaranteed damage. So if that's the min max optimization strategy anyway, like why not just lean into it? Sorry, go on.
Yes, no, I enjoy it. It is like hard, like very hard. Also, I'm playing on like the recommended hard mode, and I definitely hit like a difficulty wall. Where I'm just like, and the thing is, you're supposed to get wrecked. It's one of those games, but when you take a loss, like the invest, so there's also no XP system. Does that make sense? So you get like loot at the end of missions. You get currency that functions as XP to upgrade your guys. So if you lose someone, it's so much more devastating. And you do get like a certain amount of mooks to spawn into game with, but it's rough. So like if you take a bad mission, you're just fucked.
And you're Iron Manning it, or you there's no mid mission. There's no like,
it's very Darkest Dungeon style, where a encounter is a series of small encounters that whittle you down. It's great. No, I enjoy the game. I recommend.
It sounded like the lead in made it sound like you.
I hit a hard difficulty spike.
Oh, now you're pissed at it. I get it.
And now I'm pissed at it, and I can play some other games.
Well, now I will come back to play it because this sounds right up my alley, and it sounds like mechanically it's doing exactly. It's moving in the direction that I actually. And as much as we like to shit on it, and I don't think we ever mentioned it. I was going to say about XCOM Chimera Squad, and now what's his face, the director at Firaxis, who had been in charge of all the XCOM since the reboot. Left like a couple months ago, so whatever XCOM 3 may or may not have been in the works seems very much in jeopardy. And after Chimera Squad, it's kind of like, again with the flat Earth woke, like, you know, fucking short haired black lesbians and Latino.
Oh, I played a short haired black lesbian game.
Which one?
Oh, okay. I don't know if it's a lesbian yet. I think you might.
I mean, it's implicitly, even if not.
Yeah, like, it implies that, like, your boyfriend is this older soldier, which is kind of, like, older white guy soldier, but, like, then you hang out a lot. And
I hope
never
this isn't Mechanicus.
No, this is a Flintlock Siege of Dawn, which is
the
one of
fuck?
These, like, it's a, one of these new failed, okay. Like, it's like the equivalent, it's tanked, effectively, no one's playing it, but it's free on Game Pass.
And it's single player, or I don't understand?
Single player. It is a, it is a Souls, very Souls. It's got a really good combat system that I actually really like, and it sucks how much the short-haired lesbian main character is fucking it up for me. But you play a, it is basically a tech level of the Napoleonic era in a Souls game. So it's similar. It's Bloodborne influenced. Like,
yeah, that's kind of the blood. I'm still waiting on a Bloodborne PC port because I was like, I was thinking about replaying. I was like, no, I just need. It would be nice to have it on PC. It was still waiting. No, Bloodborne is fucking awesome.
You have a like a pistol interrupt, effectively, that like is enemies really can't block it. You play as a sapper in a Napoleonic type army fighting, like, you know, demon monsters. It's very. I am enjoying how it feels, and everything to do with the story is like painful and dumb, and I hate it. And I did not get a difficulty spike, but I got a, like, it dumps you into the open world, kind of, or the open-ish world. And I was just like, eh. I don't want to, like, roleplay as this character and such. And I'm kind of tapping it. I'm getting close to tapping on that one, too. It's not like Dark Souls hard by any means, but it is, I am appreciating that that is the new trend, is that, like, it's okay to be, games to be, like, hard if it's, like, an action game. That's cool. I also played, Neon White, which is a Japanese, like, speed running game, effectively, where it dumps you into, like, shooter parkour levels, and that's really good, but it also is, like, really, really hard to, like, get gold on these, and you kind of have to, like, go back and do these speed runs and go get more abilities or more knowledge and, like, come back and do it, which I actually kind of don't like, but it's interesting. I haven't really found a new game that I've really, like, you know, played to completion, unfortunately, because I have the ability to just tap out of these things. Well, it's not
I used to feel kind of, like, guilty. Part of that is because it's definitely a holdover from the days, yeah. You know.
But when I play a game, you guys will hear about it, and you can know it's really good. So, sorry.
And I'm glad to hear that Mechanicus is worth. I believe I got it for free on the Epic storefront at some point, and just had never even installed it. And I look now, and I saw it in my library. I'm like, okay, cool. So I can just install it and see. I don't even have to do anything. So that's fun.
Oh, did you ever play the Mafia series of video games?
Not really, no.
The remaster came out for free on Game Pass as well, and I
remastered the first one?
Yes, the first one.
The second one is like the Godfather simulator, right?
Gangster. You're playing a gangster movie.
Yeah. Cool. I know it was like Grand Theft Auto, but like the Godfather or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. It's very fun. I'm playing it on, like, unfortunately, I played it on, like, classic version, because I wanted it, it's, like, I try to play games on the hardest setting, which, you know, because games are kind of easy, I'm good at them, and if they're bad, it's not because of my skill, it's because they're bad, and I have that confidence, but the car handling on, like, the hardest difficulty locks you into, like, classic, non-remastered car controls, and this is a late 2000s open world game. And it's got like that garbage vehicle handling.
Why would they do that?
Which I deal with for the first half of the game. There is one point where it is legitimately a race car race on a race car track with these mechanics. And while it is doable, you have to win and come in first.
But like literally, why would they? I can understand giving players the option.
I want to play with, like, hardest difficulty, but
yes, but couldn't you play with hardest difficulty in terms of, like, I don't know, aiming and health and stuff, but keep the vehicle controls?
That is not an option. That would drop me out of the hard mode.
No, I'm saying, like, as a developer, that's just an extremely dick move.
Yeah. I mean, I respect it, but fuck that. Like, you know, like, I do, but it's rough. Like, it's worse than GTA 4 vehicle controls.
I it's funny because people have like PTSD flashbacks about the remote control vehicle stuff in Los Santos, but yes. Or whatever the, what was the California was it called GTA fuck I can't remember anyway people know what I'm talking like the LA one the rap music one and I don't have like it wasn't but I do remember exactly. I do remember being like, "Oh my god, this fucking sucks." I did it. It wasn't like that hard, but I can't imagine trying to do it now. Fuck that noise.
Yeah, I actually really enjoy. It's like combat is. It's you're playing a movie, so the combat scenes are very few and far between, and very like difficult. Like if you walk into a room with three dudes, you're gonna it's almost like Hotline Miami levels of hard. Like you gotta be really on your shit, and I really enjoy the combat of it. The driving, and there's so much driving because it's one of those games, is profoundly miserable.
All right. Well, as Warhammer Mechanicus is installing, let's. Speaking of Grim Darkness.
Oh, I have one more joke because of the. I've been playing Game Pass. Okay. We will do this, but we will. It's a good transition. I hate to ruin it, but
it's gonna stay stepping on. That was fucking. Anyway, go on.
No, it was a good one. You can just do it again. Game Pass like sorts games into fun ways, and one of the fun new categories is Hispanic Heritage. It has moved all of the Gears of War games into the Hispanic Heritage category.
Inevitable, I guess.
That's fucking funny. Yes. I mean, yeah. Yes, the main character has a you know, Hispanic last name, I believe. No, he does it. It's
his best buddy very much like played up as Hispanic, which at the time was kind of whatever.
Still is whatever. No one really cares. Like, Gears of War La Mexicana. Yeah, like, I'm sorry. Right. Like,
that's just...
Also, like, Mexican guys get Goku tattoos. They don't get Marcus Fenix tattoos. It's like, I'm sorry. Or Gears of War tattoos. They get, like, I've no one's ever considered this to be a Hispanic game in human history.
Not at all. But whatever. So, yes, all right. In the grim darkness of the far future, there is only Cope. Lots of it to go around. Did you want to talk about Israel Cope first or Ukraine Cope?
I did a lot of Israel Cope.
That was a great. If you haven't checked it out, Lewis was on Mike Check last week, and it was a very very it was an extended appearance and a great show. And I was actually because I listened almost all the way to the end, I was thinking the whole time I was like, oh man, it's great. I was like, oh, is he gonna ruin a bunch of our you know, Ukraine takes that we've been working on behind the scenes. And fortunately, there was just so much Israel content that that kind of got sidelined. And I know it's less, I guess, interesting to Mike generally than the Israel stuff, which is understandable. In some ways, the Israel stuff is much more important, certainly in terms of just like the actual power, the direct effect on the actual global power structure. Yes, inarguably, situation in Israel is... And I guess probably as we're recording now, they'll have their takes. Did you, in the absence of the official TDS narrative, did you want to talk briefly about the protests in Israel? Or do you just want to get straight to Ukraine?
I think TDS covered it really, really well, actually.
Okay.
And there's not too much more to add. I do want to add that the heads of the opposition parties who are in the war cabinet were there too. Like, people in the Netanyahu war cabinet were turning out the protests, which is a... generally not a good sign for a unity government, right? Historically. So
no, not at all. I didn't know that. And that's quite damning. I mean, that tells me... Well, okay, so that's actually another great transition point back to so we do Ukraine. So similar thing happened actually yesterday as of this recording. And I guess I'll try to get this up on... I don't know. We'll see. Where essentially half of the Ukrainian government resigned.
Or was fired. It's kind of fuzzy.
Well, yeah, I mean... There is always that kind of a question. However, the Kuleba, who's one of the few names that I actually knew, who was the foreign minister, seems to have been fired more so than the others who handed in resignations more so than they were fired. What I suspect, but I mean, this is purely speculative, is Kuleba was on the chopping block for whatever reason or reasons, or either he, what I mean, again, this is what we can, let me start with the basic thing. So yes, so the foreign minister was essentially fired. Dmitry, I believe, Kuleba is the last name. And then one other minister, and then a bunch of other ministers and undersecretaries, were forced to resign or resigned in protest at his firing is my guess. Or, I mean... one way or another, people are being made to take the fall for failures that are mounting and rapidly becoming critical to the extent that they're being...
Were any of the ministries... That's one of the weird things for this, because I don't want to counter-signal you immediately, but...
No, it's fine.
The people that resigned and the departments that they are of... Like, so
we're not military aligned. That's true.
Yes, it's very...
It was not the military Kuleba departments.
Was officially, or somewhat, like, it would say, well... he couldn't convince the Mongolian government to arrest Vladimir Putin to face trial at The Hague, which is retarded. Like,
well, I don't. Obviously, that's a. I mean, that's not. Nobody believes.
Yes,
that, right?
No one believes that. But like, But so, like, he obviously was going out for some reason. But
well, I do think there are real diplomatic feel. I mean, that I'll get into my, like, again, this is all theory and speculative, but I'm just trying to make sense of the data. And,
yes, but like, but all the other department, it seems like if you were to if you were to just putting on my like Sovietologist hat from like reading all these Cold Warriors back mm-hmm. in the day, that Kuleba had a faction in the bureaucracy that were his godchildren, if you will, in Soviet sense.
Again, he's one of the few names that I knew. What that means is that he had enough of a profile that someone like myself, you know what I mean? Like, if you see it, it's for you.
No, I'm saying, but the reason people are resigning is because they are in his faction, which now sees themselves as out of government.
Yeah.
Not, which means this is not accountability for the failures. This is like a bureaucratic infighting.
Okay, but why? I mean, maybe that.
And also, people want to get out of the way of that. Like, people do not want to be in the Ukrainian government right now for, I think, a lot of
reasons. There's that as well. And the parliament is in a, I mean, there have been stories for a while about issues that parliamentarians. In the Rada in Ukraine have been having. When I say accountability for failures, I really do. I think it's more like, I mean, what I meant was, or what the way I'm conceiving of it currently is, essentially, most likely the Kursk offensive was coordinated, to the extent it was coordinated with anyone, probably with British military intelligence. U.S. was cut out of the loop because it was understood, like, for a lot of reasons. Basically, it's retarded. Like, the whole... Michael Kaufman, who I have nothing but contempt for, and who's one of the most odious kikes on the planet, right? And who's done nothing but lie. This is like, the number one spokes kike for the Institute for the Study of War. What is it? Fred Kagan and Victoria Nuland outfit. Michael Kaufman is like their public facing kike that they have to like lie in public and mislead people on purpose. And all he's done for 2 years is just lie and mislead people on purpose and speak pretty much 180 degrees, the opposite of the truth, and do the very Jewy. I was laughing when they were the interview with Walter Block that Borzoi and Mike were. When you talk about like 1 degree, they're like, we're 179 degrees opposed, you know, but we have that 1 degree. Like, yeah, Jews do this thing where they take like the one, it's like they take 1 degree and turn it into 179 degrees opposite of the, you know, 1 degree aligned with the truth turns into 179 degrees away from the truth, right? And anyway, yeah, so that's the Jewy thing that they do. And there was an article again in, I think it was like Foreign Affairs, which is like, you know, extreme neocon rag, where Michael Kaufman was basically saying, like, I mean, he came as close to defeatism as I've ever seen. And he put it more in terms of, well, you know, the strategic aims of the Kursk offensive are not clear. And this was undertaken, you know, it has challenges and opportunities, but it hasn't, whatever, you know, it's good that it wasn't, which, I mean, I guess I agree with that. He was saying it's fortunately it wasn't a repeat of the counteroffensive over the summer, you know, just hurling themselves against prepared defensive lines for no, like, I mean, it's unclear what the logic there was, and it's unclear what the I guess there it was unclear what the tactical logic was. Here it's unclear what the strategical logic is, and
I made a better. If you want to listen to that Mike Check episode, I made at the end made a what I think is a pretty good case for what they're doing.
Why don't you just lay it out?
I
listened, but for our audience, it may not have.
Okay, yeah, because this is the free show. That's a paid show, but right. Hey, come on, guys, pay. There's no way to pirate anymore, so shit. The Donbas front is a massive grinder of hundreds of thousands of men on each side doing, you know, doing a big war, right? The forces that were sent to Kursk could have been sent to New York, right? New York was on the verge of falling. Under Zeluzhny, they probably would have been, right? In terms of what those forces achieved, in terms of tying up Russians, sending 10,000 extra guys into where are probably 300 to 4,000 guys fighting already, just in total on both sides, it's a drop in the bucket. Nothing would have changed in the Ukrainian calculus or Russian calculus, really, other than like an individual settlement falling slower. By sending those forces to Kursk, they have tied up probably 30 to 40,000 Russian troops. That is like 1,000 times more in terms of like requiring Russian commitment. And I believe that the Russian, and I this has been more vindicated with the History Legends did a great video a couple days ago, that the units in almost are falling back to a fallback line. I think that's getting more and more clear where it is.
Yeah, it's Pokrovsk. I mean,
like, across to the Southern Reservoir.
Which, and by the way, I found the audio
because they don't need to hold all that ground anymore. History Legends has really good sources, probably the best guy for this in terms of like him and DPA, I think. But the Russian, the current big armored fist that's making all this ground is not being reinforced from like Russia proper. They are forces pulled locally from Chasiv Yar and other like strong points they were contesting with the Ukrainians. So they are not getting reinforcement and resupply from Russia proper, because that Russia proper is getting tied up into Kursk. It is local, like inside the front redirections. So it is, I think the Ukrainians had an objective, and I think they are achieving it. I don't like this narrative that. I think it's been History of Legends.
It made
sense before the History of Legends video shows what units were on the ground, because I didn't know either that the forces that were sent to Kursk were like blocking units because they were ideological that would be keeping other units at the front that were Ukrainian. But the History of Legends guy, I dropped the ball on this. The units on the front all three of them are pretty well known, popular, ideological.
In like, Kursk.
On Donbass right now. It was 25th, 47th, and I want to say 15th. I forget what they are. The Crimea guys. The guys whose, like, battle cry is, like, flags on Crimea or whatever. all three of those brigades that are, like, doing the falling back are well-equipped, probably manpower, reinforced as they can be, ideological, pretty high-speed formations. It's not, like, a bunch of TDF falling back. There is... of course, like TDF in there, but the majority of the brigades.
Yeah, now
are
that
really good.
Well, so the question, so that was actually an armchair warlord speculation, and he was upfront that it was a speculation, and yes, it does seem to have been refuted that the reason for the manifest crumbling of Ukrainian lines in the Donbass front is low quality territorial defense, National Guard type units. Routing essentially now because they were free to, because the blocking detachments that would fire on them from the Ukrainian side when they were retreating were sent to Kursk. That does not seem to be true. So whatever. As far as the purpose or the effect of the Kursk offensive, I certainly think you're right that, first of all, losing slowly is not a strategy. It's the military equivalent of, yeah, we lose a little bit of money on each sale, but we're going to make it up on volume. You can't, like, if you're in an attritional battle, especially with Russia, but really just in general, if your possibility space is narrowed such that your options all involve losing just more or less quickly, then you got to give up. I mean, which frankly, I mean, and in the big picture, that is and always has been their situation, which is why this war should never have happened in the first place. But whatever, they don't see it that way. And they, I think you're right in that the logic such as it is was, yes, you know, we can take this gamble, we can do the Hail Mary, the high variance play, and at least it gives us a shot to do something. Now, as far as like first of all, I just don't I just don't think that it matters. Like, yes, you're probably right that they're, I don't know, about 30, 40,000. Could be. I'm just like, that seems high, but certainly not impossible. Yeah, there's some very much non-negligible number, at least 15 to 20,000 Russian regulars of various, you know, degrees of capability on the front line in Kursk. Yes, that's true. And those troops aren't available to do other things. Now, I mean, Russia has been on a recruitment spree. They were already recruiting, I believe, about 1,000 new... I think it was a day, something like that. There were the people entering the pipeline, and that was increased by the Kursk offensive and various other recent, like the essentially Russian society is increasingly behind the war, and volunteers are up. Rates of volunteering to serve in the Russian military are up. Versus, I think it was kind of lost, and there's been a lot of, you know, frontline type news. But the Ukrainian government announced, I don't think they signed it, but there were plans, or there was a, they unveiled a bill, let's say, to go after the families of draft dodgers. Because I mean, we've talked before. I it was funny. I was laughing because I saw your story that you got from your source about people essentially, like, the smart way to draft dodge in Ukraine was to allow yourself to be drafted and then desert. And then I saw the same story in the New York Times talking about exactly that a couple weeks later. And then, yeah, and now the story is the government is going to deal with that by going after your family if you do that. Now, that's obviously going to be why, you know.
That's the thing. Okay, so this gets into some, like, almost medieval type things. You ever read about, like in the Middle Ages, like some horrifying punishment for some crime, you know, like, oh,
of course, drawn and quartered and stuff.
Yeah. The thing with, like, that kind of thing is that's something you do when you're a very, like, weak state, actually. Like, that's a symptom of the state being weak, is that if you actually can't catch criminals, like, the few you can, you have to do, like, horrendous shit to try to create some kind of deterrence.
Okay.
The Ukrainian state is not competent enough to actually, like, execute on this in any meaningful way. And I think everyone kind of realizes.
I don't think it's actually going to happen in any meaningful way that they're going to prosecute the families of draft dodgers. My point is more that for all of the nominal on paper manpower, it's not like showing up at the front, and they don't seem to have the resources internally to be able to get it to show up at the front. So when I look at it that way, like, basically. Again, I get what you're saying, and it's true in the abstract that where I actually think the effect is really felt isn't in however many tens of thousands of Russian National Guardsmen, you know, let's say it's 40,000, could be, it doesn't matter, because those are just like, they wouldn't be, those guys wouldn't really be doing much, and they would just be, if the front line moved to the Dnieper, or they were, like, currently Kiev were under siege, then those guys would just be doing what they're doing in Kursk. But, like, in Kharkov, right? They'd just be sitting around doing rear guard pogey type shit, right? So it doesn't really matter. Like, what actually matters is that Wagner and Akhmat are in Kursk. Because those
and
guys...
And the 810.
Yeah,
and
right.
Also, my other thing is that there are units. So, okay, imagine you are a... You're in, like, the deep rear of the Russian military. Like, you're refitting. You're a regular unit that's been pulled off the front, you're in Rostov-on-Don or whatever, at your depots, getting more recruits and training them up and getting more gear, and you would have been rotating in to a unit in Donbass. There's no way that, I just don't believe it, that, like, those guys who were slated for Donbass rotations that were pretty much ready to go aren't being rerouted to Kursk.
I am willing to believe that. Now, it's possible. I mean, I guess my main takeaway...
You are not sitting on a full strength, like... But
you're not sitting on a full wait, sorry. You're saying
you're not sitting on a full strength brigade to do, like, rotations in a place where you're already winning.
Well, that's what I'm. I guess that's my point. Is, like, they're winning and, like, they're winning decisively in Donbass. So why? I guess maybe in theory they ideally ought to be.
So the fear is that among the Ukrainian general staff is that this the advance in Donbas will kind of accelerate into this kind of domino effect and pierce this line before it's fully manned and fortified and operational, right? So you go to Kursk because the rotation, the lack of rotation, even if they're advancing in Donbas, is absolutely being slowed. They're taking
No, it is not. That is not true. The it's accelerated. And it's the acceleration is not slowed. The Russian army is advancing 1.5 to 2 times faster in Donbas than it was before the Kursk offensive. So that's just not true.
No, they're taking like frequent operational pauses. Like if you
but there's no evidence that that's tied to personnel issues. I mean, you'd have to do that.
No, it's like it's literal exhaustion. Like you can't.
Or it's just you got to reposition your howitzers.
Yes, but like that.
But that's just not related to reserves.
I think these things all play. Like these units are getting reinforcements and resupplying, but it's not at the rate they would have been. Like so they're sending up replacements into units that are already fighting, not sending up fresh whole units and rotating units out. That's meaningful. Like
I think it would be meaningful if it were leading to. I mean, you're essentially, as if I understand correctly, you're hypothesizing that in the absence of the Kursk offensive, that the rate of the Russian army's advance would be even faster, and I just see no reason to believe that. I don't think they're limited by the rate at which. I don't know that they're taking enough casualties.
I think they would have been
for reserves to really matter. Like, and even if it's just exhaustion, like they have their own internal reserves anyway. I mean, they wrote like divisions or whatever. If you're a frontline division, you have divisional reserves. You don't need strategic reserves, right?
I just don't see like I think would have happened in absence of Kursk would have been New York or wherever holds for an extra 2-3 months and then falls away in a much more rapid advance.
It's like Bakhmut or Avdiivka type thing again,
but like but much harder to stop this time because of the during Bakhmut. Like the Russian absolute manpower in Donbas was much lower, right? Like there wasn't too much to the Bakhmut didn't domino out of Bakhmut. They actually got stopped relatively quickly.
Like, yes, that's
like,
true.
They're still fighting in the suburbs of Bakhmut. Like,
that's right.
You know, or they're not suburbs, exurbs, I guess you call them. But I think the risk here would have been they get out rotated very effectively after New York falls, and there's a uncontrolled, you know. Advance. This is much more controlled.
Well, again,
it's really one breakthrough.
Maybe two.
Chasiv Yar still very much holding. Everything south of that little reservoir is still very much holding. Donbas is holding in most of the places. It broke through in one because they're going back to a fallback line. I really don't see this as like chaos. And even the Ukrainian propaganda, which generally is like denying of these such things, is doing like videos of them heroically covering covering the retreat of other units, like the 45th sent some battalion down to do some mission to extract a battalion of paratroopers under fire. Like, you know, they're not. It's clearly not a rout. Like, this is clearly organized.
That's true. And I don't think
aspect.
It seems on to me, maybe even their position has somewhat improved in terms of like accepting that they're going to lose territory, and so
because Sirsky is a good general, yeah,
right. Because it did seem like for a moment that it was kind of on a knife edge, and they seem it doesn't quite feel that way currently. So sure, but I mean, as far as the effect of the Kursk operation itself, I think the kind of overarching recognition that losing slowly is not going to win the war is that's a healthy instinct. And I mean that's true, and in that sense, sure, why not invade Kursk? As far as like actual tangible objectives, I just don't see it. I just don't. I don't think up like even Akhmat and Wagner, because like you're again, like the all that they're doing fundamentally is wasting resources. There's no if you can't translate a BMP and a howitzer shell into concrete, tangible. I don't even just mean territory. I mean like the territory. Who cares about the territory? It's just dirt. Like what are you after? What is the actual objective? And I think that's more than anything, like, where the lack of strategic logic shines through, because there's no, like, what is the Ukrainian theory of the Kursk offensive? What is the Ukrainian theory of the war? I mean, do they have one? That's the question. Kaufman was asking several times. Like, he raised the question. Like, he basically said, I'm almost quoting him verbatim, it's not clear what the Ukrainian theory of victory is. Like, it doesn't.
And I do want to say he's such an odious kike, yeah, because, like, it's his fault.
Like, oh, absolutely. Like,
so I do think, so to come back to the initial, we talked about the bureaucratic, like, wars in Ukraine. I think if we were to put these on factional lines, I brought up how there's the NGO faction, the Sorosite faction, and the Zelenskyite faction are different factions within the Ukrainian liberal government. And ISW is clearly in the Sorosite faction, like, obviously, right? And the faction that just does resignations is, like, more of a kind of a bureaucratic careerists that would have been anywhere, and now they want to get out of the way because things are getting shitty. I think that's very clear. And I think the Sorosite faction is increasingly losing faith in the Zelensky faction. And you're saying ISW also covered, like, friendly fire incidents in Ukraine by the Ukrainians, which is like, well, why are you covering that guy? That's kind of an admission. Like, obviously it was happening, right? But, like, you know, like, I think there is like internal bureaucratic.
Yes, I completely agree. And I imagine that it's related at some level. I mean, well, obviously it's related because it's blood related because they're the same fucking people, but to the internal fights in Israel, right? Over, like, how are we going to deal with Netanyahu is a very similar question in certain ways to how are we going to deal with Zelensky.
Which is funny that I think the solution is in many ways the same, where they're hoping for the NATO to actually just come in and
just solve all their problems. Right. Deus ex America.
America, yeah. And that, like, which is, I think, what Netanyahu's plan is effectively. It's eternal war. Provoke this thing with Lebanon.
That's clearly true. That's clearly true. What's less clear to me is what is going on in the Ukrainian government. I mean, it's really, they seem increasingly isolated, and to me, that's the real lesson of the resignations. And again, just another piece of the puzzle. Because again, okay, look, it's true. I haven't been paying super close attention. I saw the 47th, and they've done, you know, their very good unit. So, okay, there's, you know, I'm less up to date on the specific, you know, patches involved in different theaters. But what I think you got to look at this. Certainly the American theory of the war is like a gayop. Like, this is, the whole thing is a gayop. It's all intelligence.
American theory of the war, I think, is to lose this very slowly and then go into a guerrilla war and make it like Chechnya.
Yeah, right. Which is retarded in its own, but sure. At this point, probably, I think that's the Fred Kagan, Victoria Nuland, sinister
Chechnya
plot.
Chechnya times 6 million, whatever.
But here's the thing, like, that in and of itself, like, I don't know. I keep waiting for the day of reckoning, and it keeps not happening. But it feels closer and closer. Like, the thing is,
so I have one more possibility, of the war that might actually be true, and it's actually very horrifying. Russia has still not taken a major, of the major cities.
That's kind of the direction I was going. So,
and
go on.
I think there's a chance that when it comes, let's say Kharkiv City is the city. To that, where, like, in the city things fall. So in Bakhmut, in these smaller cities, the cities are basically evacuated because they're relatively small. They're basically evacuated, and the war happens in an empty city. I think there is a theory, and it is based on legitimate Soviet fucking doctrine, where every male in this city is armed, which gives you, like, fucking, and Kharkiv's a big city. Yeah, it gives you, like, what, 200,000 troops?
Minimum. Yeah.
And women too, and, you know, every, and I don't know if Russia can swallow that pill of killing that many fucking people. Like, that will just, even, like, both morally and in a industrial sense.
I mean
it's hard to kill a lot of people who are resisting you.
I don't think that's actually going to be that. I mean, they were already bombing Kharkov pretty bad.
No, bombing pretty bad and like turning it into Gaza.
I understand. Well, I don't know that they're going to turn it into Gaza. Also, a lot of people left.
If the fortress city thing is pulled off,
I don't think it's a question of the number of bodies involved. I think it's purely a political question. I think it's like a symbological question or whatever. Like it's the political geopolitical.
I think Kharkiv has to be encircled first. Like you can't even go in until. Ideally. So just to put this back in the Cold War, in the old Fulda Gap scenario, NATO war planners expected German cities to just declare themselves as open cities, which is a Napoleonic warfare term, which actually is still around. It's still illegal. It's actually still, I believe, in the Geneva Convention. Cities can declare themselves open, which means they are effectively all non-combatants, and they will not resist in any manner when you come in, which makes it illegal to strike at your city. Happened in World War II a couple times, actually, too, and World War I. It's a legal status. That, I think, is the hope of the Russians, that we'll get to Kharkiv, and it will declare itself an open city. If we encircle it, it will. If that doesn't happen, things are going to get horrifying. And I do think that like it's not that hard to hand out AKs and RPGs to everybody and have enough commissars.
Oh no, it'll be a slaughter. It'll be terrible in that. But I don't think that's like. That's not. I don't think going to be dispositive. I think what's more dispositive is the, I think Zog feels they're correctly that their backs are up against the wall and like a caged animal, you know. I think when it starts to set in, that's what I was getting at in terms of the Day of Reckoning. I think when it starts to settle in psychologically. Which I would have expected. I expected a long time ago, and still hasn't happened. But this Kaufman piece in Foreign Affairs the other day was, I think, it was telling in several ways that process has at least started. But nowhere near. I mean, he was talking about like, oh, we just need to build up shit until 2025, and then we'll go back on the counteroffensive. I mean, you know, again, fundamentally just disconnected from reality. But the political consequences in the West in terms of just the whole system, just the Pax Americana, which is already, I mean, there's for completely unrelated reasons is crumbling, and Turkey just applied to join BRICS formally, officially. They want to, you know, which again, okay, it's to whatever extent it's even a real thing, which is debatable. It's an economic thing, not a military thing.
I'm a big fan of white papers on this, that BRICS isn't real, but yeah. I will add the caveat that BRICS is the I hate America badge.
Yes.
The country can assign itself.
Right. Exactly.
It's saying, actually, I hate America, which is very funny for a data member to do, but like we knew it was coming to some degree.
NATO, Turkey's been the odd man out in all sorts of ways. You know, Turkey, whatever. That's the Turkish question is another. I mean, it's a different thing. Yeah. But again, purely analytically, geopolitically, Turkey signaling that they want to join BRICS or whatever. Like, you can say that that's a purely symbolic thing, and in some sense that's true. But okay, but what kind of but what's the symbolism though? You know, and
the symbol is I hate America.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. And, yeah. And so, like, so for Turkey to do that is quite something. So, I just don't. That, and that's what has me scared, is when if the Russian army surrounds Kharkov and issues this ultimatum, like
it's Kharkiv, the Ukrainians still control it.
Is that the point where Zog is like, okay, no, for real though, we're in charge and don't you dare question it?
But what do you mean? Like, what does that look like? You mean like sending troops into Ukraine? Like,
yeah, or like nuclear fuckery, or who knows, man. That's what I'm saying. These are like absolute. These are the worst. These are the most psychotic criminals in human history.
Well, actually, I want to push back on that because you mentioned the ISW guys are cucking now. They are actually not the most psychotic. Like, they are optics kikes. Even though, like, yes, they're horrendous and evil, but they are optics kikes.
ISW specifically, yes.
Yes, that whole NGO, the Sorosite faction in Ukraine.
Yeah.
It's almost 100% optics kikes. Not too many, very few. The Likudniks are like doing stuff with like Azov Battalion. They're like on the fringes, you know, which is very funny. Once again, I think they seem to be positioning more for a step down, in my opinion. like ISW is actually not preparing for like Eternal War. It's like, actually, we're gonna let this one down easy. Seems like that's the vibe I'm getting with like.
Maybe, but I don't. I mean,
okay, so for instance, in terms of like, remember the test balloon theory that say, oh well, NATO should send X equipment to Ukraine. No, they shouldn't. And then like 4 months later, it shows up in Ukraine.
Right.
The last test balloon was the Polish-French plan to militarize the Kursk border with their troops. That test balloon went up, and that's just, and like everyone was like, no, fuck no. No one was going for it at all. Like, I think that there's like, we have reached in many ways the limit of what you can actually supply.
That's what I'm saying. That's my point.
Which means the only option is stepping things down. I don't think like, well,
yeah, but what does a negotiated settlement look like?
So let's say, I'll throw a scenario at you. You get Zelensky is not a coup, but like the NGO faction takes over. And Zelensky cannot step down from like his demands. They offer the four oblasts and maybe Kharkiv and then peace.
No. Well, not without a constitutional guarantee.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, you can't join EU. Like, with the, yeah, you can't, neutrality, Austria style, you can't join any things, you know.
I just don't think that's on the table. I actually question at this point. I think Putin could probably force acceptance of that deal if he wanted to, and I'm sure that's his instinct is to want to. I don't know how much internal political capital he'd be willing to expend and how much internal opposition he would face. So those would be significant unknowns.
He could pull that off, I think.
If he really wanted to, he could pull that off. I don't think the West is capable. I don't think there are mutually acceptable terms. I think in terms of not so much the territorial concessions, but in terms of the neutrality status. Like that's not, because both sides at this point, like first of all, the Americans never intended to, and NATO and the EU and the Jews never intended to abide by the terms of any of those deals. And Angela Merkel's on tape saying it. I was actually shocked, but I shouldn't have been. But I naively believed in the Minsk process to whatever extent I was like aware of it or thinking about it and had heard of it. And then especially after the war broke out, sort of like, you know, yes, there had been. I when the war broke out, I understood it more as because I, you know, in the lead up, what was it like in the December of 2021, there was a lot of posturing on both sides. As I recall, I'd have to look it up, but as I recall, it was essentially Ukraine was looking to change, either to formally apply for NATO membership or something along those lines. It was they were going to change formally their diplomatic status. They were seeking a change in their formal diplomatic status, and this was accompanied by a significant ramp up in artillery shelling of the Donbass front. Against the Donbass militia positions, and then the Russian invasion was really like almost. I mean, they were very clearly, Ukraine internally was very clearly ramping up to do an invasion of Donbass. Like that was very, very evident. It was just, that was what was happening, and essentially throwing down the gauntlet. And then yeah, Russia threw down their gauntlet as well. And then it was on. But like all of that happened in my mind, and I think in a lot of people's, certainly in the Russians' mind, under a general kind of like regime of we're at least seeking, in principle, we're seeking a diplomatic solution, and maybe the government in Kiev is somewhat out of, you know, they're, whatever, they got retarded, you know, they're retarded meathead Slavs, right? These are the, you know, people in control of Ukraine have been since, well, at least since independence. Okay, we can work with that. That's been revealed to be false. That the West never had any intention of abiding by the terms of the Minsk Accords. The whole thing was a sham. And subsequent, like, they already, like, when that tape came out of Angela Merkel, and that was, I think, a year ago, it was a while ago, there was quite a bit of discussion of it on the, like, the Russia Telegram and Russia kind of, you know, I think Medvedev said something about it on Twitter. It was a big deal, and rightfully so. And they have said again and again and again, I mean, like RT and the, and official and unofficial, like the Kremlin and Russian media, you know, and have all been saying for a while, particularly after Kursk, but even before, with some of like, oh, was it the Crocus, the theater massacre? Remember, people, it's ancient history at this point. But when, you know, it was how many? It was like 100 something people were murdered as a part of this. What was I mean, it was of course speculative, but they blamed it on American intelligence. I think they had every right. I think that I'm sure that's a correct attribution. They're not going, like, the Russian side, like, the Americans would say whatever, they do the very Jewy thing of just make whatever agreement you have to make in the moment, with fully intending to never abide by it, right? The Russians did not have that understanding of what the Americans are up to. Now they do. And that's a qualitative change. So I just don't see the Russian government. That's the thing. I don't see Putin regarding, like, constitutional neutrality. You can have constitutional neutrality as long as Russian peacekeepers are allowed all the way up to Lviv, right? Okay, then you can have constitutional neutrality. Oh, yeah, that's not, you know, you want constitutional neutrality, but, like, you get to maintain an army and NATO gets to, no, sorry, that's not happening, right? And so it's going to be it's like whatever, like, the verbal thing is as far as, like, lines. Like, yes, I don't think Putin cares about lines on a map. Very sad. As a map painting autist, I find that very sad. I love lines on the map. I love maps. It's true. But, you know, it's fine. He doesn't, like, that's a different way of approaching it. The thing is, it's going to have to be in terms of concrete hard power. It's going to have to be in terms of, like, you know, the agreement, as I recall, in the what was it, the April deal that fell through in 22, that Boris Johnson flew to blew up, was like numbers of tanks and planes you're allowed to own, right? Because that's the level at which these things are negotiated. That was the same situation that Germany was in after the First World War, right? And that was, you know, famously, there was all this hilarious. I love, like, it's a total side note, but it's been it's been great on Twitter. Like, normies, like sovereign bra, it was a fucking faggot normie, was like, how long do you think it is until the normies or the masses start questioning whether it was 6 million? I was like, okay, so we're now at the point where the normies are doing, asking when the normies are going to wake up and realize the Holocaust is fake. So that's great. So this is all very good. Lots of World War II discourse happening.
Also, I mean, it's really funny how it's literally on a 3-year clock. Every right-wing Twitter yeah. joke is 3 years behind whatever they're doing on Tedious.
Yes. Yep.
I saw a really good one that reminded me of, they basically said they were doing, I could walk by an unintended bike, no problem.
Bit. Oh yeah, I saw that. And I was like, oh my God, that's Mike's joke.
Yeah. I can walk by an unintended Crimea, no problem.
But anyway, yeah, so this is the kind, I'm just saying, like, in real serious big boy grown-up, like, international realpolitik, like, that's how you do things, is you talk in terms of concrete numbers of objects and individuals and real situations on the ground. You don't, like, you can wipe your ass with the Minsk Accords, right? And so that is that, and that's why, to go all the way back to this Day of Reckoning stuff I was talking about, like, as far as, you know, when are these people going to face reality? I don't know. Maybe not until they die. But, like, the thing is, there's no, I just don't see the Jews in control of the American State Department are going to insist on, like, toilet paper that they can wipe their ass with that isn't going to, you know, they're not going to be, nobody. They have been relying up until now on the willingness of the Russian government to take promises at face value and in lieu of concrete hard stuff. And I just don't, it's not going to work anymore. So the war is going to continue. And I think it's going to continue, yeah, at least to the point where Kharkov is encircled. I mean, fully under siege, surrounded. And then it's a question of, like, are they at, like, Are they willing to take the L? Are they willing to take, like, that big of an L? That's the thing that scares me, is because I, if there's one thing that, like, the Jewish strategy about all of this is, like, never, ever, ever take L's ever. And it's scary.
I do think, once again, in my, like, nightmare scenario with, like, having to Gaza, Kharkiv City, that is also the point where the NATO will have to do, like, the, or do they step in at that point, right? Like,
yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, that's the kind of thing. It would.
But I think
that and that's another reason, like, why Russia has all these
no fly zone or something, like, you
know, well, that's just a declaration of war. No, that we're that's a show. That's gonna, that's like a, that's a, you could declare a no fly zone on, like, you know.
Well, they would. I'm saying, like, just can't do to that. Basically, give the Russia. So you gave the Ukrainians the NATO air forces, effectively. You know, like,
yeah, that would just be a declaration of war, and I actually think that would be, like, quite to the end. No, that's the thing about all those tens of thousands or however many troops in Kursk, like. All those guys, that's what those guys are there for. Like, that's literally what those guys are there. They're there to you know, protect Kaliningrad, if that's what it comes to. They're there to do all that kind of stuff, right? They're not. The bulk of the Russian military remains in Russia. Okay, yes, they're high power guys, and active duty. Everybody, you know, the resources are primarily oriented towards
Kontraktniki.
Yeah, exactly. But the bulk of it has always been in the rear, and like they have never, you know, to their own detriment. It's, you know, the map painting Spurgs been pulling our hair out from the beginning. Like, why won't you just? But okay, they have their reasons, and it's understandable. And they, you know, there's also their own internal political angle still of seeing this as a brother war. What were you saying?
I think we're kind of beating this to death. Do you want to kind of talk about the actually significant change in the war that's not, like, more shithole potato farms you've taken? Oh, the rate of potato farm acquisition.
We actually didn't do any increase. We didn't do any little lines on the map drawing, but that's all right.
No. Well, because the Ukrainians already have a good map line for us drawn from Petrovsk to the reservoir.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For Petrovsk,
it's a natural parapet. It's a railroad. Yeah. It's kind of like a naturally built up wall, actually. So anyway.
I went back and looked. I was talking about the E50 highway in May 11th. You can go back and look about midway through the episode. I was highlighting. Now, I said, and I still stand by it, that the drive down the highway isn't actually aimed at Pokrovsk. I mean, it is, but it's on the way to Pavlograd, which is the big Dnieper crossing, and that would open up the way more or less directly to Kiev from behind. In other words, bypassing the river on the, which bisects Kiev, but of course they would fall back in the event, or whatever. This is all hypothetical, far in the future, or whatever, at least a year, 2 years, maybe, but depending. But in any case, yes, they do seem to be falling back to Pokrovsk and generally consolidating lines in Donbass in anticipation. So go on.
Let me do some real, the actually significant things is that, and this is, I cannot underrate how fucking important this is, and the Russians have changed their ballistic missile targeting from strategic national level to divisional brigade theater commander, which is such a truly cosmic shift in how this conflict is going to look. And it means the Russians have made an absolute shitload of ballistic missiles, of conventional ballistic missiles of all types. And also, it means there's no more Ukrainian air defense.
Well, so, a lot of these missiles, just to jump in, you said conventional. Yeah, I mean, they can be loaded either way, right? Like, they're typically loaded with conventional munitions, but they don't have to be.
Yes.
which is also part of why NATO is shitting its pants. I mean, this is part of, that's an important part of the story.
Yes. But in the first three fucking years of this war now, we're getting up on, these ballistic missiles would get targets from, like, either national satellite, KGB, or GRU, whatever, FSB intelligence. And they would give this to the National Aerospace Command, who would create a strike package that would fire enough missiles to get through to hit certain targets of import. And this meant they couldn't be used for other things quickly, like very accurate counter-battery fire against HIMARS launchers, air defense, bases and depots. So it was you would see depots would get hit, but they would get hit, like, if it was, like, a huge depot or an old depot or but like you couldn't really use them for counter battery fire on enemy artillery because things changed too quickly to do that whole bureaucratic process. The national fucking Russian airspace, like the Russian Air Force has to like basically collate all these things, pick priorities, make a strike package. And they have to do strike packages, which means it basically means a strike package is a bunch of missiles and drones to get through air defense. Now, air defense is significantly attrited that they can give the targeting. So the aerospace force are still launching these. I think it was overstated how much it, because they were saying they've attached the missiles to like divisional headquarters and stuff, which make, yes, like on paper, but they are still like in the Russian aerospace forces in the rear, like deep in the rear. They're just getting orders to hit these things. And they are no longer under review of national military intelligence, national intelligence, even like political control. Like the Kremlin would have to sign off on all these things previously, or national aerospace forces, like high command. So we're getting much faster, smaller, much more accurate strikes on
time on target targets. Is like minutes essentially from like tactical ballistic missiles. Yeah.
Yes, it's almost like we saw them do some wild stuff with Iskanders. Where they were like, they had eyes on a, I believe it was a HIMARS, or no, maybe it was a Patriot, one of these, you know, significant target systems. And they let it fire once, followed it with a drone, locally, drones are commanded locally,
right, yeah,
to its resupply. Like it met up with it, it fired, it shot and scot, shooted and scooted. And then as it waited till it got to its rig, its support forces linked up with it, and then they hit it.
Mm-hmm.
Wild shit. Stuff you really can't pull. Like, you need to have
insane really intelligence, but they have it. Yeah.
Yes.
And not and just the intelligence,
they,
but the...
And they,
yeah,
and they always had it. That's one of the things that frustrates you with Russians in their bureaucratic ways is they always had Orlan drones tracking these fucking things, but they would move before you could get up the fucking 6 million chains of command, be signed off by the fucking Kremlin. I assure you the Kremlin was signing off on Iskander strikes. It, like, had a strike package put together, which made that was Ukrainian defense. But now they're just hitting them. And that's going to put a massive dent in, and they're going to be hitting not just like these. Currently, they're doing high value stuff. They hit the this school full of school children, which was literally like a military training. That was some retarded shit. That was like literally a military training facility.
Now those were those. My understanding, are those junior officers or just recruits?
I've seen a lot of different things that it was like a job school. That seems to be the most like it was like so some signals training battalion. So like,
because people say like, oh, it's just like, you know, 80 dudes with rifles. I'm like, well, not necessarily.
It's radio. It was like radio operators in training, like kind of like an AIT if you're familiar with the American military. As from what I understand,
that's a pretty.
There was
job,
some speculation it was like Swedish or
Finnish, I saw this. Yes,
but I don't think that's true.
No, I'm sure it was. I mean, there might have been a Swedish person there.
Yeah, but. I don't think it was a NATO. Like the thing is always like 6 million NATO advisors killed in a strike is like a Russian refrain, right?
Yeah.
So, but they're going to be able to like once they work down from these high like your IRIS systems, your Patriot systems, your HIMARS and stuff, you're going to be see these hitting like regular mortars and artillery of the Ukrainian military, and that's when like things are going to get like dark because. Launchers are fine. Like, so I was actually asked this question recently. Why doesn't Hezbollah have any like field guns, right? Hezbollah's all about rockets, right? And drones. They don't have any like howitzers or artillery. How do they expect to fight a conventional war? Which is a good question. I guess it's a perfectly smart question to ask. So there's with artillery, like shell artillery, the launcher is expensive and the projectile is cheap, right? With rockets, the launch platform is very cheap and the projectile is expensive. So when you're Hezbollah and you can expect massive counter battery fire from like way superior intelligence, way superior time on target from the Jews, it makes sense to invest in rockets, right? Because you want the projectile to be better at the cost of the launcher because the launchers will die. Just get the projectiles out. Whereas with shell artillery, the launcher is the important bit, right? Obviously. And Once artillery pieces start getting hit a lot, they are hard to replace if they're getting hit at a pretty good clip. Obviously, they have infinite money and infinite M777s from the Americans, but once those begin to like fall in large numbers, it will be it gets very hard to like do artillery as support. Also, the Russians own the skies effectively, even though they don't own the skies in terms of airstrikes. They still have to do things with glide bombs. They own the skies in terms of unmanned vehicles. Like the Ukrainian drone, they don't have. The Ukrainians no longer have high flying unmanned drones of any kind. The Russians do. Orlans and whatever current iteration their new ones are, they have just spotters flying around. Yes, they die. Yes, they get hit by Ukrainian air defense, but it's unmanned. That's the point of it. And this is going to tie in with these fast reaction ballistic missiles, and absolutely, I think, really, really hurt the Ukrainians in a way that might actually get in the loop of like. So there's a current like replace. Obviously, they lose some pieces sometimes. They get replaced by the Americans. If that rate changes a lot, things could it could get legitimately hard to replace not just artillery pieces but also crews and these kind of things. So I think that this. Like, it's a tactical thing, quote-unquote, not a strategic operational thing, so it's, like, less important in the analysis sense, but I think this could have big knock-on effects.
Well, also, JDAM certainly did, right? Or whatever, the FABs. The bombs, the FAB. Yeah. Yeah, FABs this is like one of the big stories.
This is, I think, of greater import than the FABs, actually. The FABs are good, but they are, like, just, they're just bombs, effectively. They don't have the... So they are accurate, right, to, like, a GPS coordinates, but they are not, like, reaction accurate, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're not,
well, you
like,
gotta
fast
scramble
as fuck.
SU-20.
Yeah, they're not fast as fuck. These missiles are fast as fuck. It's very hard to do counter-battery with FABs, obviously. You can do, like, defined defensive points. And also, the FABs are kind of a... So, I mean, obviously, they're successful, and they're doing a lot of work. They are a shitty kludge. Like, I would mention...
Yeah, they're not... Yes.
They're
not JDAMs. Yeah.
That's not why they're bad. They're like, they are like still like in like FABs like often miss or fail to detonate. They are kind of like, I mean, they will get better as the war goes on. But FABs have you can watch them miss like hard. They whiff occasionally. They'll be duds. The Iskanders are and the rest of the ballistic Russian missiles are really really fucking good and like a mature technology pre-war, whereas FABs are maturing during the war.
Mm-hmm.
So the ballistic missile stuff is. It's much better, and it's more playing into the Russian strengths. The Russians actually don't, like, it is a weird place for the Russian Air Force to be doing, like, a bunch of CAS. Like, that's not kind of...
It's not how they're built, no.
But also CAS with fighters instead of frogfoots.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think this is, like, of all the tactical things, this is as revolutionary as, like, the FPV drone rollout in terms of how it's going to have knock-on effects. The Ukrainians will not be able to get forces together in like meaningful number. To put it very clearly, Ukrainian offensive operations are basically done because any concentrations on the way to the line now
are just going to get hammered before they get there. I agree. Yes. Which is another reason why we haven't really talked about it, but maybe close the loop on it and before we head out. I don't think they're going to be able to move the troops. From Kursk, I mean, they may be able. The troops that are there now can hunker down. They can retreat in good order, slowly back into Ukraine. They cannot be rotated to Pokrovsk. They cannot like those guys are there because as soon as they try to move them, that's the problem. They're going to have exactly the problem you're talking about. They cannot be moved quickly or in great numbers.
Yeah, that's why you have to do these. I mean, both sides have this problem too. So the HIMARS obviously caused it for the Russians.
Well, there was a Russian grouping that got caught. It was like 100 guys. Yeah. It was another. You know,
good convoys getting hit with these things. I think that perspective could come overstated, but like it's more about how slow you have to run things, and then that pre-attack concentration is the.
Well, they're not going to be able to have it. Yeah.
You can move in a distributed way. It's you know. It's been
slowly, yes, but in terms of the kind of rapid reaction, that's just not going to be. They're not people. I'm just saying people were in. I guess I saw in Ukraine circles they were talking about, you know, moving guys around and stuff, and it's like, no, it's not. No longer really possible.
I mean, this has always been a war of companies and platoons,
mm-hmm.
but it's going ever more so. I think it's going to trend more that way and less that way for the Russians. It's trending into a war of battalions and brigades for the Russians. And a war of companies and platoons for the Ukrainians, which is obviously it's not good, right? Like,
No, well, that's not, again, there's no, like, yeah, I mean, this is the stuff that makes me anxious. Yeah.
Also, if you speak of less of a sea change, have you seen the new Russian infantry tactics?
Which one? I mean, maybe
they've gone to two-man. They've gone to two-man squads.
Yes, I have seen this. Yeah,
it's very, point, yeah. very small squads. This is a reaction of Ukraine FPV drones being relatively plentiful.
Right.
But so now to kill a squad of Ukraine, even if you have like perfect hits and perfect getting through Russian EW, it would require like six or more, minimum six FPV drones to stop a 12-man Russian squad. That's a lot of investment to kill one squad in a scarce resource, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have a... It's going very interesting. The Russian infantry is getting better and better and more aggressive in weird ways. Not, but also, it's playing against the Russian strength, which is interesting. And they, once again, I said they've tried... They're becoming more battalions, but their infantry tactics are getting mm-hmm. even more distributed. So who knows? That also does slow the pace of these advances, too, because, like... they're not able to go up the gut as hard and fast with like BMPs on a road. Now they're like, it's literally, they're going walking speed. They're like going to like, they're going to walk to Petrovsk. It seems like, but that does work. And especially if you can get getting guys with fucking satchel charges, like it's the song.
Oh man. Yeah. Like some of the Metal Gear Solid shit that's coming out on Telegram is wild. Well, I'm sure, you know, there'll be plenty more. Did you have anything else or did you, I don't know if you wanted to,
oh, I have one Hezbollah take I wanted to get out that all I right. couldn't get it on mic check. I followed after the somewhat disappointing strike on Israel that was possibly was foiled to some degree by IDF air raid. I've noticed that the pace of so Hezbollah, I don't. It's hard to you know get in their heads and the heads of the resistance party over there, but. They have returned pretty hard to just like the traditional mortars, RPG, or mortars, ATGMs, war in the north. Like, I don't know how much they even like the rocket thing anymore.
Hezbollah.
It seems like Hezbollah has achieved its aims of depopulating the north of Israel.
That's true. And they are, that seems true. If I not mean, yeah, for now.
Enjoying it, they have a much closer force parity in the border war when they're like doing ATGM sniping and. Drones against like one little vehicle or you know mortar shells into like the border war like kind of went on hold as they were like gathering for this rocket thing, and I think the Hezbollah actually is would now I mean, obviously they're known as like the rocket guys, right? I think they are increasingly preferring this like infantry border war, both because it makes propaganda easier and also because it's
you get
more
cool
like,
footage for sure. I mean,
and they're, all, and they're basically at parity like. It's light infantry against mechanized infantry. Okay, that's a fight.
You yeah, get, right? yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, not even all that. I mean, light mechanized infantry, right? I mean, it's not. They're not.
yeah, the Jewish units aren't running. They're not running a bunch of Merkavas. You can call it,
maybe and Merkavas there, themselves you know? Are you know not exactly heavy armor. So and that's their have those are I believe their heaviest units. So I guess they have some Abrams probably, but not.
No, it's all Merkavas. That's yeah. one thing you actually don't want to mix. Like if you don't have to, because it's such a small army that
right.
like, having two tanks.
Yeah. So they're. I mean, essentially weird. they're in very lightly. They're essentially in BMPs is what they're in. And yes, that is a fight that Hezbollah can absolutely win. And seems largely to be. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah, certainly.
Yes. Also, I have a good yeah. source, Lebanese source. And he brought up, because me and Mike were kind of down on the strikes, right? Because they kind of didn't seem to be very effective, and they probably weren't super effective. Not that we'll ever really know. And then also, so there were only, so obviously a lot of launchers got hit. Hezbollah is good with their martyrs. They actually take a lot of pride in how many martyrs they have in these operations. You know, they post that shit really quick. They only lost two guys in those strikes. So maybe it wasn't as effective a foiling. As the Jews obviously overcalled their strikes, like over, you know, propagandized their strikes, but I don't, maybe it wasn't quite as foiled. Now, Hezbollah also, as everyone over there, it's tradition if you're a resistance force, is they have their launchers and then they set timers on them and then leave them. So like, you know, there's not actually a guy pressing the button on the battery of missiles. But so it's possible they destroyed a lot of launchers and didn't kill many
Yeah, that's kind of my. I mean, that's sort of.
But only two is very, very light for like a total. We totally foiled your thing type of deal. I think it's possible they got a lot of like the grad. Well, they're not really grads, but they're Airstats grads in Katushas. But oh well, you know, it happens. But I don't think Hezbollah was like very damaged by like. There's this. Hezbollah's capabilities have not been diminished. If that makes sense. This operation didn't go very well.
I mean,
but they
in the grand sweep, because I remember for years, really decades, Hezbollah, as you say, have been the rocket guys. I mean, sort of, you know, every so often you bust out rockets and lob them into Israel to kind of go wherever, and sirens go off, blah blah blah. This is different, and I don't think I was joking earlier, but I think you made a really good point about the propaganda being easier. It's not even just that it's easier, it's that it's a very different kind of propaganda. I mean, this is, you know, seizing territory or clearing out, actually depopulating, as you said, the north of Israel. That is a huge win. And continuing to take the fight on the ground, in a sense, okay, I'm sure the rockets have their uses, but, I mean, compared to, like, IEDing a BMP, you know, that's a different thing.
Yeah. Also, the Jews are really, really upset about the North not being peaceful yet. The school year is starting soon in Israel.
Those poor Jewish kids.
But, like, they're actually getting, like, logistical problems of, like, well, we moved 20% of our population to other parts of the country. How do we, like, do this? And that's also partially motivating. That's also why you get some people in the street in Israel who are pissed.
Oh yeah,
because they literally don't have houses to be in. So
they don't
like,
have houses.
They're like in a refugee camp or in
a
hotel.
Is it 20%? I didn't realize it was that much.
There's about 7.5 million people in Israel, and about a million and change have I think a million from the north and a quarter million or a million and a half from the south had to move.
Wow. Yeah, that's
no,
a
maybe
lot.
A quarter million in the south.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a significant chunk of the population. Yeah.
Yeah, you can only imagine the kind of that. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they're in a very tough geopolitical spot. I don't see how eventually the jig is up, of course, but it seems like Netanyahu's days are numbered, like in the not that many. Although I don't know, I guess it depends. I mean, if he does drag America into a war, then I guess he could stay on until it's over, and then
Yeah, I think that also. I think Netanyahu is wrong, and I think the Jignats are right, or the optics kikes are right. The Jignats are wrong that Israel just needs actually any ceasefire. Like any ceasefire is better. Like they just go back to what we were doing before. It's like the actual material losses of October 7th were not that big,
right?
Like in terms of even in the war that they're
and Netanyahu himself clearly doesn't give a shit about the hostages. So like whatever.
Yeah, but I think the best move for Israel would be to end this conflict.
For Israel, yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But for Netanyahu, he oof. So, yeah. So maybe he gets.
I think he's holding on until the Trump election, and if Trump wins, Netanyahu may be solid. I think he's putting a lot of his chips in the Trump basket.
I think that's true.
And he could definitely stretch this thing in November.
He can stretch it to the U.S. election, no problem. Barring some total, he shouldn't have a problem with that. But I think you're right. If the notorious anti-Semites Kamala Harris and Chuck Schumer take power, then the result would be disastrous for Bibi, I'm sure. Well, yes, for him personally, it would be that probably would.
Yeah. Also, you get the weird parliamentarisms where actually prime ministers have like insane amounts of power. Like even a minority prime minister can like do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Like you could just like not hold elections.
Oh yeah. Well, that's what Macron. I mean, as we haven't nobody's really talked about it in our spheres, but like Macron lost snap elections and hasn't done anything. He was like, oh, you put it on a delay.
No, he not only lose the communists won.
Right.
The leftists.
Yes.
The leftist one in his coalition with a coalition with him.
He is like the minority party within the coalition, and he has not formed a government with his majority partners. He's just like, ah, yeah, we're not doing that.
Yeah. I mean, what's his name? Fucking, well, in Canada, Trudeau has been a minority leader for, like, yeah, for a while now.
But he, yeah, I don't think he called elections.
No, but he did, like, call
no,
it
no, no, I know, I'm just,
law.
Yeah, right. But no, Macron literally, like, called the elections, and they're like, okay, great. Back to your jobs, everyone. Like, okay. Yeah, it's funny, all kinds of shit. Yeah, it's, buckle up, we're not done yet. We're not, I don't know, I don't think there are breaks on this train. So take care and stay safe, everybody.